After talking to Michael Galinsky a couple of weeks ago in the TEDx that he did out in North Carolina, and some of the words that he was talking about and the way to which that he presented it, and some of the blowback initially that came from TEDx when they took it off the YouTube page, which it's back on now, by the way, which I'm very happy about. It got me thinking to when I had one of the leaders of the Boulder Back Pain Study on the podcast a few years ago. That was Dr. Yoni Ashar. And I thought, hey, let's revisit that. It's been 4 years. So we're gonna listen in on that today. I'll be right back. It's so nice to have you back on the show. It's October the 15th, 2025. Thank you so much for being here. If you're interested in supporting the show, there's lots of patrons on the that support this every single week. Patreon.com/TheMindAndFitnessPodcast helps the publishing fees, helps keep the lights on, helps the interviews flow, all that kind of stuff. So I'm very grateful for all 23 of you that are currently in there right now. As I said, Dr. Yoni Ashar, he worked on the Boulder Back Pain Study. I had him on the podcast a few years ago, and we talked about the origins of this study, some of the findings that they had, some of the data that they came up with after the fact. It was a great interview. So let's listen to Dr. Ashar and I from December 9th, 2021, episode 204. Today's interview is a big deal. Dr. Yoni Ashar from Lynn Health, but he was also huge in the Boulder Back Pain Study, and that's what we get into today. Let me give you a little bit of a resume highlight on Dr. Ashar. So Yoni is a clinical psychologist, neuroscientist, and a father of three. Yoni's research uses functional MRI, brain imaging, natural language processing, and other tools to understand how mind and brain process influence health and chronic pain. He's an NIH-funded postdoctoral associate at Weill Cornell Medicine. He completed his doctorate at the University of Colorado in Boulder, and his research in chronic pain has been featured in several news outlets, including the Wall Street Journal, Vox, and the Coloradan. Amazing. And one thing that's pretty cool, too, that that I did not know going into this interview, and it started to click, is that colleagues of his include Charlie Merrill, who's done the podcast a couple of times, and then Deb Malkin, who also did the podcast a few weeks ago. So it's pretty awesome. Just a small, small, small world. So without further ado, I mean, really, the man deserves as big of an intro as I can give him. But really, let's hear his story. And that actually this work was not something that began. I love hearing the twists and turns and kind of how I was at dinner last night, actually, with the board of directors for this organization that I'm a part of. And one of the people there is a tenured professor at a college. And she was asking about coming to speak to her students about how, like, you know, the path that you think you're going to go on doesn't necessarily equate to the path that you're going to end at. And I think it's so fascinating. So we'll hear how Dr. Ashar got from where he began to what he is doing now, because I think it's fascinating. And honestly, he is one of the absolute, if the people listen, if you're listening to this and you have a hope of mainstream medicine capturing what this podcast is about and the idea of the mind-body connection and being more globally accepted and something to where, hey, if you go in to see your doctor, they're not going to prescribe you to go and take painkillers and do six MRIs and go to physical therapy three times a week for the rest of your life. Like, he is one of the guys that's going to ultimately make that impact and have allow this to get more mainstream. So that's what I'll say. We all will owe a tremendous amount of gratitude to Dr. Ashar years down the road, I guarantee you. So without further ado, here is Dr. Ashar. Okay, so I teased it in last week's episode. I had said that I didn't want to give away too much, but that I had a heck of a guest coming up, and he's here. So Dr. Yoni Ashar out of Manhattan, can you hear me?
I can. Thanks, Eddie, for having me on the show. So fun.
So I did some Googling of your background and I got to know a little bit about you. I have to say that it's quite the honor, because of especially some of the work that you've been doing the last 3 or 4 years, which are things that we'll get into during the course of this interview. But maybe before we get into that, just tell us who you are. What do you do? What's kind of your, you know, your current line of work and the things that you focus on? And then, and then we'll go a little bit further in it. But for the moment, what are you doing right now?
I am a clinical psychologist and a neuroscientist. I'm at the Weill Cornell Department of Psychiatry. I'm a postdoctoral associate. And I am also a consultant with Lynn Health, which is a great pain app and service. And I am probably most famous in recent times for my work on pain reprocessing therapy and this research study that was published just a couple of months ago.
Yeah. So, so I got your information from Christy Weepy. And at the time when her and I first met 3.5 or 4 years ago or so, she was at the Pain Psychology Center. And she had made this mention of a Boulder back pain study that she couldn't give away really too many details, but it was something that she was working on. Is that what you're referencing?
This is the Boulder back pain study. Christy, the fabulous Christy, was flying out to Boulder, you know, back and forth from Los Angeles to see patients in our study. Her and Alan Gordon were the therapists. So that's how I got to know Christy.
So one thing that because I hear from listeners all the time, there's somewhere between 15 and 25,000 or so people that listen to every episode, and sometimes more, sometimes less. But when I can see like a global map of where all these people are, and I get emails from people that live in all different parts, from Australia to South Korea to Japan to different parts of the world. And one thing that a lot of people really struggle with, they have this long-standing pain issue. They've had a diagnosis or maybe not. And they kind of find a lot of the work of Sarno or some of the books that are on the topic as very kind of theoretical and almost like unscientific. However, to me, the entire intent of the Boulder back pain study was to bring, quote, science into this. Not to say that like Sarno didn't cite studies and journals and things like that in his books, but
he didn't do any research.
Right.
Never did a single research study.
Yeah. This is the piece that a lot of people were craving.
Exactly. And, you know, yeah. And so that's what we tried to do with this Boulder back pain study, was to really put some of these ideas and techniques to the test, because there's been a lot of, you know, evidence that these kind of, you know, psychological behavioral treatments can be effective, but that evidence has mostly been anecdotal. Like people like you, Eddie, who've had these like amazing recoveries, but it's not part of a study. And so it's, you know, I think that's really like limited the ability of these kind of treatments to enter mainstream medicine and the kind of just mainstream approach to treatment, and kept them on the fringe.
Was there something in particular that caught, like, I always tell, I make a joke often about the thing that I went to school for, which did not translate into the thing that I'm doing now. And I feel like that's true for a lot of people. Like, yes. Was the, you know, when you were first looking at just like going to do an undergraduate degree, was it, I'm going to get a I'm going to focus on this and I'm going to get into mind, body health, and I'm going to help people cure chronic pain. So what was the original plan if you and I were talking before you even got an undergrad? Like, what did you want to do?
All right. So undergraduate was computer science, and I went into software development. That turned out to be kind of like unsatisfying, boring for me. And then I got really interested in spirituality and meditation. And I went to Jerusalem and I studied Torah for 2 years there and got really into meditation. And that was amazing. And I kind of thought I was like wanted to be a rabbi for a bit, but that didn't quite land. And then I saw this lecture given by Richie Davidson, if people know him, about like the neuroscience of meditation. And I thought, this is amazing. This is what I want to do. I can like merge my interest in meditation and spirituality with science. I'm like, how sweet is that?
Yeah.
And I was lucky enough to be able to get a job studying meditation at the University of Colorado Boulder. And we ran some research studies looking at something called compassion meditation and using functional MRI to study how, you know, compassion meditation changes our brain responses to suffering others. And we could talk about that, you know, a different time. And that was really fun. And I was in this research lab that was studying pain. And to be honest, at the beginning, I wanted nothing to do with pain. I thought pain was a dark and dismal subject. Like, who would want to study pain when you can study compassion?
Right.
You know? But there was this line of work happening around me on placebo effects in pain that really caught my interest, like the power of the mind to change your experience of pain. And that kind of that unfolded into this Boulder back pain study. And so that's some of the winding path to how I got into this field.
So quite the twists and turns. What about what was it about meditation initially that caught your eye? Because meditation is one of those things where everybody thinks they suck at it. however, I've been listening. Are you familiar with Z-Dog? Like, does that sound familiar at all?
No. So, but I'm kind of disconnected from a lot of pop culture, so
yeah,
I don't know.
Yeah, so it's not pop culture. He's actually a he was an internal medicine doctor at Stanford, and now he's in Vegas and he does private practice and all that kind of stuff. But he's got this really great podcast, and he just went and did it was like a 6 or 7 day silent retreat. Dr. Zubin Demania, but trained at Stanford. That's where he's a Stanford trained physician. But he talks a lot about meditation, but doesn't really get into what about it interests him. So what about that interested you in the beginning?
Probably two things. First is just some of my own experiences in meditation that felt like I was sort of like transported to, you know, a different plane of reality, a different state of consciousness, a really wonderful, lovely, calm, you know, blissed out state. And that was really interesting to me. It was like, whoa, I could just close my eyes and sit here and do certain things with my mind. And then, you know, and then have these like amazing experiences. And then the other thing was just the idea that, you know, so much of our experience can be influenced by how we think about and interpret events, like that you could think about something differently, you know, whether you're happy or unhappy, is whether you're, you know, miserable or satisfied as a matter of perspective, you know, to some extent, obviously to some extent. And not absolutely. And so that was just such an interesting idea, that we spend often so much time and effort trying to change our external reality, whether we know we're hustling at work or whatever it is, or when you know, focusing on our internal reality could have, you know, great effects as well.
Give me an example.
Meditation as a way to do that.
Give me an example of that. One question I've gotten each of the last 2 weeks that I've done a show has been around, you feel like you're in an unavoidable situation, as an example. So you have a job that you hate, you have a spouse that you fight with, you have kids you don't get along with, or friends that you fight with often. And the people will tell me that I know this is the cause of my TMS and my symptoms. However, I keep telling them that really experiencing it internally is really kind of the anecdote for all that stuff. So can you maybe go a little bit deeper into internal experience?
Yeah. So here I'll be foreshadowing some of what we'll come to later. But in PR, in pain reprocessing therapy, PRT, one of the main like tenets is how we appraise, or how threatening or how safe we make out the world around us to be. So, and that a lot of times we feel really threatened and really unsafe by things that are really not threats. And so I'll just give an immediate example from my life. I have a grant that's due tomorrow, and I've been feeling pretty stressed about getting that in. But when in reality, it doesn't really matter that much, like on the whole. And so if I look at that, I could say like, oh, big threat, there's this deadline, and then I could get very anxious, I could have a lot of muscle tension, and you know, that could drive a lot of symptoms, indigestion, everything right through the autonomic pathways. And or I could say like, oh, this is not a threat, like I get it then or I don't, but either way I'm gonna be safe, I'm gonna be fine, and I don't need to perceive that thing as a threat when it's really just an opportunity that like I don't need to take, but I could take it, but I don't need to take it. And but I could, they like put myself under a ton of pressure to try to get something done that's really optional.
Do you find that, because I have those kind of thoughts internally, meaning Sarno a lot talked about in his book a lot about like perfectionist personality and perfectionist tendencies, yeah. which is a lot of what you're describing. Yes. You know, never allowing, never allowing yourself to make a mistake and never messing up and stuff like that. Does this sort of path of indifference that you're kind of talking about, as I'll describe it, does that lead to people? You know, how can people reconcile that, being able to have some indifference and not taking things so seriously or allowing themselves to get all worked up about things, but like at the same time, like they want to succeed or they want to have certain things in life that they feel they could only get if they do, you know, if they do push it or have a perfectionist personality? How do they reconcile that?
Yeah, you know what I hear in your question, Eddie, is that there's this like really appealing idea for many of us that if I have X or if I accomplish Y, then I'll be happy. And I think a lot of us have the experience of, well, we get X or we accomplish Y, and then, you know, maybe we're on a high for a couple hours or a couple days, but it's not really a lasting change in happiness or something like that. And it's not, maybe we're not doing it for the happiness. Maybe we're doing it because we care about it. Like, you know, it's a change we want to make in the world because we believe in it. But if we're doing it because that we think then we'll be happy, we might be fooling ourselves. Mm-hmm. That it's really kind of the internal attitude that can help us.
And so what's the process behind like meditation in that regard? What is it allowing people to do to essentially reach or achieve what you're describing?
Yeah. Two things come to mind. One is that in meditation, we can get some distance from our thoughts and we see that thoughts are not facts. So a lot of the day we have thoughts running through our mind that present themselves as facts. Like, I need to get this done, or this person hates me. And those are thoughts, and they may or may not be true. Or sometimes we don't even know if they're true. We can kind of guess at the likelihood. But when we're kind of going through our day, a lot of times it's hard to step back and say, whoa, is that thought really true? And do I want to, you know, fully buy into it or not? Like, you know, particularly around threat, like we feel really afraid of something. It's like, is that really a threat? And the second way that meditation can help, I think, is just settling down our system on a like physiological level, getting more parasympathetic, you know, drive and letting, you know, muscles relax and regulating the breath, like all these benefits on a more physiological and settling the whole system.
So you're saying that even just the, like the nature of kind of let's say that I'm thinking about a stressful situation right now. Like I got a client who I'm waiting for a signed contract to come back. And the thought keeps racing through my head. Hey, when I get this signed contract back, I will be happy. I'll be satisfied, but it's not going to last that long. But if, and I'm all worked up about it, but if I can literally just pause for that moment and I'm saying to myself, well, if they don't send it back in the next 10 minutes, like it's not a big deal. You're saying that, that act enough is slowing things down emergency. Enough. What was that?
No, it's not an emergency. It's not like they have to get it back like right now.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah. So it's really even just that act of stopping and just recognizing this is not a that this is not an emergency or isn't as critical in this particular moment slows things down enough to where it's having an impact at the nervous system level, is what you're saying.
Yeah, think so. Yeah. Wow. Now, that all this being said, and you know, the many benefits of meditation being documented, meditation alone doesn't seem to be all that helpful for chronic pain. So there's been a number of studies now on mindfulness-based stress reduction, mindfulness-based cognitive therapy. These are basically meditation programs for chronic pain. And there are benefits, but the benefit in terms of, you know, reduced pain intensity, increased functioning, reduce disability, increase quality of life, but these benefits aren't large. They're more in like the small to moderate range. So I don't think meditation alone, you know, is going to cure most people of pain.
Yeah. Is it more of an instance of an accumulation, basically? This is a supplement to other things that they could be doing?
Well, I think that, you know, I think pain reprocessing therapy is really a promising approach, which has a mindfulness meditation component to it, but really centers around a new understanding of your pain and learning to kind of think and feel differently about your pain.
So give me an example. So I'm working with you, and my back or my neck has been killing me for years, and I'm going through this. Yeah. And, you know, it's like, I'll give you an example. We talked before we started recording about, you know, what's my background in this? And I kind of laughed and said, I'm just a fan, really. But I do remember kind of being in the depths of that. And I remember, like, before I would go to bed, I would be kind of Googling symptoms and trying to find cures for certain things and kind of doing all that. So that was the last thing right before I fell asleep. And then usually the first thing, you know, I'd get up and I'd go in and start to get ready for my day, but my phone would be there and I would be like typing up, you know, different ailments or something and what could a cure be for those. So it was like, you know, it was all
that
the time.
Did not sound fun.
Yeah, it was throughout the day and there really wasn't a lot of room for hobbies at that point in time. So what would you do in like a pain, and I know this is super general, but a pain reprocessing therapy in an element like that, yeah, or somebody that has that, like what are we doing in the sessions?
Yeah, so first step is assessment, which is figuring out what is the cause of the pain. Is it the degenerating disc? Is it the, you know, superior labral tear in the shoulder? Because it turns out that, you know, superior labral tears and degenerating discs are highly prevalent in pain-free people. In fact, most people who have no pain will have some kind of tear or disc change or something like that. So these are often not the cause of pain. So we need further assessment to establish whether they actually are the cause of pain. Just the fact that they're there doesn't mean they're causing the pain. And there's a whole assessment process, looking at a history of different symptoms, looking at whether the symptoms are moving around the body, you know. First is my left shoulder that was hurting, now it's my right shoulder, or it started on my shoulder and now it's going down my arm. So this kind of mirroring or spreading, these are all indications that the brain is playing an important role. And what we're trying to do here is see whether the pain may be what we're calling neuroplastic pain, where there is actually, you know, the pain is driven primarily by changes in the mind and brain, and we think that any problems in the body, either there's no problems in the body or they really have a very minor role in the symptoms. So that's step one, is assessment. And that is a really important step, because after that we come to education, which is letting people know that, oh, this is neuroplastic pain, there's nothing wrong with your body. And the pain is due to these, you know, basically your brain learned the pain. And that's really good news, because if your brain learned it, it can unlearn it.
So is it like continuous, what's the word I'm looking for? Just essentially, like, as you go through the sessions, like, what is the goal? Is it usually, are people coming for 8 sessions? Is it 6 months? Is it 2? Because I think one of the things that, one of the things that I know that I would be leery of, because all the physical therapists and especially the chiropractors that I had seen, you know, one of the things is they would make a diagnosis and they would say, we're going to work together 3 times a week or 2 times a week or 1 time a week or whatever for 8 weeks or 10 weeks or 12 weeks or something like that. And it kind of felt like it was never ending. And then you kind of get to the end of that and you think it's the end of the road. And you don't really feel any different. And that's a story that I hear over and over again from people that will come to me and say, like, I had somebody not long ago that said they've been doing 2.5 years of this, of different things, whether it's journaling or whether it's meditation or whether it's going to see a TMS therapist, and they don't feel like they're making any groundwork. What would you say to somebody like that?
That's a good question. So in the Boulder Back Pain Study, which we just published, people had 9 sessions delivered over the course of 1 month, and the outcomes were really fantastic. So I would say, my first thought is, you know, has the person, do we think that it is neuroplastic pain? And then if so, has the person really accepted that? Have they really bought into that? Because I've, you know, worked with a number of clients who sort of buy into that, but, you know, part of them believe it's neuroplastic, but part of them is really committed to the story of an injury or some kind of disease process causing the pain. And so I would be curious about how completely, how much buy-in there is. And then if there is a lot of buy into that model on a cognitive, intellectual level, like, yeah, I know it's neuroplastic, but I'm not getting better, then my question would be, to what extent have you been able to let go of the fear of the pain, which is really, really hard to do. I'm not trying to make that, you know, it's simple, but it's not easy.
So you mentioned letting go of the fear is a big piece, not trying to diminish that because it's not an easy thing, but go right. A little bit deeper into that.
Yeah, because there's the cognitive piece, like the rational brain, which is like, okay, I know it's neuroplastic, but do you feel that? And now we're talking about the more, I want to say something like emotional, subconscious, automatic part of ourselves. Like when the pain comes on, how immediately do we tense up? How much of a spike in fear is there, like a physiological kind of body somatic level? And because that's where a lot of the work happens in pain reprocessing therapy, is really trying to shift this kind of more experiential, automatic, feelings based response to the pain. So you got to kind of think it and feel it, and it meaning safe.
Yeah.
Feeling safe.
What's the separate? Because there's people that I know that they'll have an injury. Like for me, you know, it was a shoulder injury and I was weightlifting and all that kind of stuff. But there's plenty of people that they sustain some kind of an injury and they go through and they do whatever, you know, the rehab or whatever it is. And then the rehab's over and then they kind of don't have this sustaining ongoing. I mean, what's the makeup?
You're better.
What's the difference of the people? Like what's the, how come one person, and I know it's probably a combination of a lot of things, but
yeah. Why does it become chronic for some people and not for others?
Correct.
So the first thing is that there is now a major study underway to look at this. It's called the acute to chronic pain signatures. It's, you know, many millions of dollars of funding from the NIH that's going in to answer this question. So in a few years, we should have some like really amazing data on that. And we also have some data, you know, from previous studies that can speak to that. So there's some data showing that baseline patterns of brain activity in the ventromedial prefrontal cortex and nucleus accumbens can predict who is going to develop chronic pain and who's going to get better. And that's pretty interesting because those are parts of the brain that have to do with learning. They're not like pain regions. They're much more like learning and emotion regions. So that can predict it. Baseline imaging of the body, like MRIs and X-rays of the back or the knee, those do not seem to predict who develops chronic pain and who gets better. But baseline psychological measures of anxiety and depression, as well as like contextual factors, like if there's a lawsuit surrounding the injury, those all predict likelihood of transition to chronic pain.
Interesting.
But we don't know. It's some combination of like genetics and neurobiology and environmental factors.
How long ago did you, because I know we talked about kind of this career pivot, how long ago did you get into, you know, Well, I know you said that studying pain didn't sound like really all that much fun, but how long ago was that? How many years ago was that?
5 years ago, I got into chronic pain. I mean, now it's I love it. It's, you know, but about 5 years ago.
So, in 5 years, I mean, I don't know how much has changed in 5 years. I guess, and I know, you know, the study has come out. There's more literature, certainly. There's more books on this stuff, certainly. But from the mass acceptance level, both from just, you know, my Joe Schmo medical doctor that I could go down to, you know, I say I sprained my ankle and I go down and I see an urgent care doctor, like just regular physicians, and then also just people in general, is there like, has there been much of a shift in the last 5 years, do you think, in terms of just like, you know, common consciousness and how people think about the interconnecting of these two worlds, as opposed to you have a machine, which is the person, and then you have psychology, and they do not intersect at all, which is what I thought for a long time.
Yeah. I think that two things. Well, one, in the neuroscience community, we've known for decades that the brain plays a really important role in chronic pain. That's like nothing new. That's the neuroscientists. Like, there's been neuroscientific investigations of pain and chronic pain for a really long time, and that's been clear for over 20 years. Now, in terms of, but that hasn't really like reached out into common people or providers or practitioners nearly as much. Eddie, I do think there's been a shift. I was just talking with one of the core team members at Curable, and they were founded about 5 years ago, or I think something like that. And they said that when they first opened their doors, the market wasn't all that receptive to this whole idea, but now they feel like it's, you know, it's a night and day difference. Like, there's so much interest, and now there's just more research coming out. There's more people who have, you know, cure experiences, and maybe some broader societal shift about just general, like, you know, mind brain influences on health.
What do you think, Nicole Sachs, are you familiar with her at all?
No.
So she wrote a book on this, and she's a psychotherapist, and she's in Delaware, but she wrote a really great book on this, and she did a podcast episode a couple of years ago. It's so fuzzy to think about the pre-pandemic world versus the pandemic, but I remember where I was when I was listening to it, and I was going to like a big gathering for a birthday party, which tells me it had to be before March of 2020. But she was talking about somebody had emailed her or asked some kind of a question about basically this being like chronic pain in this light being like a mental illness. And she was saying why that was not the case. Because there has been a tremendous shift, I feel like, just in the last 2 or 3 years of the conversation around, quote, mental health happening a lot. But I feel like it's almost a little bit too... superficial might not be the right word, but it always is the next component of people say mental health is important, but then it becomes hashtag self-care and take a bubble bath and that, but it's not really like it's not how I at least now think of what mental health is. I mean, does that make any sense? Like, does that
I think so. Yeah. You know, I think one of the things we've been trying to do in this work, and that's maybe helped the shift in acceptability, is that a lot of the earlier people like Sarno had a big focus on stress and repressed emotion and repressed anger. And this was just really hard to put on scientific grounds. And a lot of people with chronic pain, neuroplastic pain, didn't have like repressed anger. Like, that wasn't the thing for them. And what we've tried to do in our research is understand this much more through like neuroplasticity and learning-based processes in the brain, and connected to what we already know about a lot of other kind of disorders, like panic disorder, which is, you know, very similar in many ways actually to chronic pain, where there's this big, you know, kind of, the central nervous system generates all these symptoms, like your heart's racing, but there actually is no heart attack. You know, there's nothing wrong with the heart. And so just connecting it to much more kind of scientifically grounded ideas and treatments.
How did you, when I say roped in, I don't mean like in a bad way, but how'd you get roped into this Boulder back pain study? Like, was this something that you was kind of your brainchild, or did somebody identify that, hey, Dr. Ashar is the right guy to bring in and help with this? And then what was your role in that?
There is a lot of serendipity. So I was kind of casting about looking for a doctoral dissertation. And I was working in the laboratory of Dr. Tor Wager at CU Boulder. And we came up with this idea on this placebo injection for back pain, for chronic back pain. And just as we were starting up this study, Howard Schubiner and Alan Gordon approached Tor. And they had been trying to get his attention for years of like saying, and then they, you know, Howard had like emailed Tor every like 2 or 3 years and said like, hey, can we do a study? But it never happened. But at this moment, Howard did it again. And I was about to start this study testing a placebo injection for chronic back pain. And we said, hey, there's an opportunity to add a third arm to this clinical trial. We could add, you know, this treatment that you've been so excited about. We could add it to the study. We just need like $100,000 to cover the costs. And Howard and Alan basically said, you know, we're on it. And then they crowdfunded that campaign to fund the study, which was supported in large part by a lot of small donors. So if any listeners were among those donors, a sincere thank you to you. And then this is how this whole thing was born. So I was this kind of grad student, and then just everything came together, you know, the right people at the right time.
And so what was your particular role in there? And maybe talk about like I'm sure there were a lot of people involved, but you know, 3 or 4 or 5 of, you know, kind of the people that you interacted with the most while you were doing that. And what was the end goal or the end hope or even the intent of the study, like as you saw it, especially in the beginning?
Yeah. So my role was to run the study. The clinical team was Alan Gordon, Howard Schubiner, and Christy Weepy. And their goal was to do the best they could to get people out of pain. That was not my job at all. My job was to design the most rigorous, scientifically, you know, sound study possible to get the best answer we could as to whether this treatment was effective. I started the study kind of skeptical but curious. But as the, you know, and you know, there's this, when you're running a study, you're not allowed to look at the data as the data is coming in, because that could bias you. So you only can look at the data after the study's over. Mm-hmm. But Alan and Christy, who are seeing the patients, would just tell me, like in the hallways, like, hey, we're getting people out of pain. Like, this person's not in pain anymore. They're out of pain. And this was like, what? Like, what's going on here? And I was very eager to, you know, see the data, because there's kind of just these rumors were happening in the hallway that like people are just getting out of pain. And for people who aren't familiar, like this doesn't really happen in you know, chronic pain studies with psychological treatments. There's, you know, some people have some pain reduction, some people don't. Maybe people drop 1 or 2 points on the 10-point scale. But the idea of someone being like pain-free at the end of treatment, that's not really like within the realm of conceptual, you know, within the conceptual realm of what we're thinking about in these studies. And so this was pretty mind-blowing for me, that we what we found, Eddie, was that 2/3 of people randomized to PRT were pain-free or nearly so at the end of treatment. And that really kind of whopped me, to be honest.
And PRT, pain reprocessing therapy, to make sure I've got the acronym right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep.
What's kind of your thought, and this is jumping a little ahead, but and this is really just a hypothesis on your side, but why do you think it is that like for instance, my health insurance plan, I can go see a doctor, pay very little to go and get, you know, back injections or get whatever it is I need to get, but therapy, talk therapy has a lot more limitations around it in terms of what it is that they're willing to cover, even though it could be a more long-lasting solution. Do you have any guess on kind of why this is how, at least in the United States, like insurance companies and coverages and things work as it relates to that? Or any guesses?
Sure, yeah. That, you know, I think there's, I don't understand the insurance system very well, but for some reason, I think this relates to what you were saying earlier, this like old duality of, you know, body's like a biomechanical machine, and then the mind is just this sort of disembodied thing, and, you know, never the twain shall meet, that mental health services are just treated very differently by insurance companies. And, I think there's this perception that the mental health stuff is really soft and fuzzy, and, you know, what are you actually doing in therapy? And, you know, it's hard to pin it down. And how do you know if someone's really doing PRT or not? Whereas these injections or these surgeries, well, those are the real deal. And that's very frustrating to me, because it's just wrong. Because if you look at a lot of these injections and surgeries, the data show quite clearly that they're no better than sham. And so, for example, vertebroplasty and kyphoplasty, these two surgeries that like fuse discs together, they're no better than sham surgery. So if you go in there and just kind of clink some tools around and sew the patient up and say, you know, all done, go home, but you don't actually do the surgery, the outcomes will be just the same.
Wow.
And yeah, I know, right? And that's also true for arthroscopic shoulder surgeries. It's true that steroid injections are no better than saltwater injections. And so all these like medical procedures that are whole like insurance system has reified as like the real deal, they're actually a sham. They're no, you know, they work because of their effects on the mind and the brain. They're placebos. So it's really inconsistent with the evidence to think of those as the real deal and therapy as the soft stuff.
Do you think that like the results of the study, and as far as like what could be done with it, like do you see anything like the way that, you know, maybe not big enough to change insurance companies and their strategy, but like do you foresee any sort of bigger mass changes as a result of you doing the study and publishing this?
I sure hope so. Yeah, we are now working. I'm in talks now with one VA, Veterans Administration site, and we're going to hopefully start up a study there of PRT. And if that goes well, then it might lead to further studies, which could then lead to PRT being rolled out throughout the whole Veterans Administration system. I'm now in talks with two like Kaiser sites, and you know, same idea, right? If we do some studies in that context, it goes well, it could be rolled out throughout Kaiser nationally. Yeah, there's, you know, we're doing a lot of clinician trainings on PRT, so we're really hoping to get this out there and ultimately societal, you know, shift that we think there's a lot of people who could really benefit from PRT or treatments that are kind of similar to PRT, that are, you know, very few people are getting those treatments now that could benefit from them.
How does PRT, because I think a lot of people will hear this and they'll think, oh, I need to go find a therapist on psychology today. PRT seems very niche though, right? Is that not like, it's a particular type, like is it just like the pain psychology center? I know that Christy is kind of, you know, she's off doing different projects and things like that now, but how could this be available to people that are listening in different parts of the world?
Yes. So there are a lot of resources out there for, you know, the ideas, and I don't want to put too much weight on one particular brand or one particular, you know, three-letter acronym. There's a lot of great stuff out there that, you know, the key thing for me is the treatment, the principles of the treatment. Like, what are the key principles that the treatment rests on? So let me just mention some resources that, that readers might want to look at. One, Alan Gordon published a great book recently, The Way Out. It's being translated into like 12 or more different languages. So that's great. Howard Schubiner on his website, unlearnyourpain.com, has these amazing videos, including in Spanish, like Spanish subtitles. Lin Health, L-I-N, is an app and a coaching service that's doing a really phenomenal job. I've had a number of people I've referred there, and I've had like a cure kind of, you know, been cured of pain or near cure experiences. And they're doing a really good job getting these ideas and resources out to people as well. And and those are all much more affordable than like trying to like, you know, find a therapist and work with a therapist weekly. So I'd highly encourage any of those resources.
Yeah, that's great. Lin Health. I'll link all three of those. I've talked about Alan's new book, The Way Out. I read it on a camping trip. I mean, it was tough. It was tough to put down. It was like I would set a timer for 30 minutes. I'm going to read for 30 minutes, and then I would find myself 45 minutes later, an hour later, whatever.
That is a good sign.
What are some of the things that you're working on upcoming?
I am working to develop psychedelic-based treatments for chronic pain. It's based on the same premise that mind and brain processes can be the primary cause of pain. And psychedelics and psychedelic-based therapies are a really strong way to engage, you know, to target some of those processes. And for me, this is motivated by, you know, some patients I'm thinking of now that it's been hard to really get, you know, I felt like I wasn't able to get it across. Like they were just kind of very stuck in this particular way of thinking or feeling. And I wish I had a more powerful tool. And I've gravitated towards psychedelics because there is some really incredible data coming out on psychedelic-based treatments for PTSD and depression and addiction, showing that these can do what you know, often, you know, achieve effects that are often very difficult to achieve otherwise. And so I'm really hopeful that, you know, for like Eddie, you were asking about people who've kind of felt like, well, they've tried the TMS approach and they kind of, you know, believe that it should work for them, but it's not quite working. You know, I would love to have a day where we can say, well, you know, try a psychedelic-based approach.
I'm on the Lin Health website, and it's funny. So Charlie Merrill and Deb Malkin are both on here. Charlie's picture's right next to you. But I've interviewed both of them. I've talked to Shannon on Instagram, so it's a small world. Yeah,
so we're all connected. Yeah, it's a great team there. Charlie, Deb, and Shannon are all great. Shannon and Deb are coaches, so anyone who signs up to Lin might get to work with one of them. And Charlie's our physical therapist, and he's an old friend of mine.
Yeah, he's great. We've done probably two or three episodes also. I'd love it if he was more local, because I think he and I, just recreationally, I think would be tremendous friends. Sounds like we're into like a lot of the exact same stuff, which is cool. So anything else? We're kind of wrapping up. We're at the top of the hour. Where can people, if people, you know, if there's a science nerd out there that wants to read this specific study, where can they find it?
Please do. So the article is open access, meaning anyone can read it and download it. It's not behind any paywalls. If you Google pain reprocessing therapy, JAMA psychiatry, or JAMA, J-A-M-A, you will find it. I wrote the paper hoping that it could be, you know, read by scientists and by interested lay people. And there's a lot of really great data there.
Awesome.
Some more data from that study that I'm working on now that I am hoping to publish soon as well.
Awesome. Well, Dr. Ashar, thank you for spending an hour here and kind of telling us a little bit more about you and your background and the stuff you've been working on. It's a great service to the world and so amazing in the last, I've been doing this podcast since 2017 and how much has changed since then and how much new stuff has happened.
Have you felt like a shift, you know, in the past 5 years from societal or?
So the shifts that I have seen for the biggest part would be, and it could just be because my eyes are open and I'm looking for it now, but I do feel like I see more instances of two people that are saying similar messages and, or two people that are giving messages and it's really like, it's the same thing. Or even like Dr. Hanscom, I interviewed him for the first time 3 years ago. And it seems like his conviction is so much more, even more, like it was strong then, but it's even more strong now. So I see a lot of that. I see almost like a boosting of people that believed in it and now they believe in even stronger and probably because of more evidence-based stuff is coming out.
Or we're just all drinking the same Kool-Aid.
Could be that too. Yeah. Cool. Well, thank you so much. I'll link all the stuff we talked about down in the show notes if people want to look at it more, but I appreciate your time.
Great. Thank you so much, Eddie. Great to meet you.